You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, 25 indigenous artists from Wisconsin, around the U.S., and Mexico are exploring identity in an art exhibit in Appleton. We'll talk to the guest curator behind the project. You may be watching out for COVID, RSV, and the flu, but now there's another virus to watch out for, and it's one affecting our pets. Canine influenza is a respiratory illness that has cases rising this year. Some states are calling it an outbreak. Dr. Sandra Newberry is the director of the University of Wisconsin Shelter Medicine Program and assistant professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Newberry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you give us the basics on canine influenza? What is it? How is it affecting dogs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most basic thing people need to know about canine influenza is to not panic about it. Mm-hmm. The first time we saw canine influenza in the United States, this kind of influenza, which is called H3N2 canine influenza, was in Chicago many years ago, was the first introduction. And what we've seen since then is that that strain of influenza really died out. And now what we see is kind of new introductions that pop up. So it's not really that it's kind of spreading all over the country. It's more that it kind of pops up in different places. When it does pop up, it causes animals to get a respiratory disease that's often mild and sometimes more severe with coughing. But it doesn't usually cause very many animals to die. It's really uncommon that it would kill an animal and it's or a dog, and it's usually because the dog has some other underlying conditions too.
Can you talk about some of the outbreaks you've seen? I understand as part of the shelter medicine program, your program actually works with shelters and other places where we might have multiple dogs together around the country.
Yeah, and I mean, it turns into an outbreak because it's still a relatively novel pathogen, and everybody knows about this now because we've been through a pandemic with a novel pathogen. And so when it comes in, it will really spread because there's lots of animals that have never seen that virus before, and so they're not protected or immunized against it. And so when sometimes all it takes is, you know, one or two dogs to go into an animal shelter setting, and then we'll have an outbreak in the shelter. What we see more commonly, honestly, than animal shelter outbreaks is we see, like in a doggy daycare center, if one dog comes in or two dogs come in that were affected, then we'll see it spread there. And when we first saw the introduction, it was happening in daycares, it was happening at groomers, it was happening even in veterinary clinics in Chicago, until we knew more about the virus.
What are some symptoms that people can watch for, whether it's, my dog or I work at one of these facilities and I'm watching for it in dogs? What could give us a tip off that this might be canine influenza?
The problem is that it's going to look a lot like all the other kinds of respiratory diseases that dogs get when you see it. And so the best thing is, just like we all know to do now because of COVID, is that if your dog is sick, they shouldn't go to daycare. And if your dog is sick, they shouldn't be around other dogs. And so when you have clinical signs of respiratory disease, that's a great time for your dog. When your dog has those signs, that's a great time for your dog to stay home and not be around other dogs.
Something people might wonder about is, if I've got a dog at home, it's not exposed to other dogs, great. But what if I pet a dog or interact with a dog that turns out to have influenza? Can I bring it home to a dog? Is it that transmissible?
You know, just like other flu viruses, the flu virus isn't going to last very long on surfaces or on your hands. But of course, if you're a veterinarian who's, working with a sick dog and you didn't wash your hands and you didn't change your clothes, you could, of course, take that home to your own pet. But the likelihood of that happening is reasonably low. The thing to be aware of, too, is that we usually find that this moves from community to community. We don't have reports right now of this being in Wisconsin. We've been working with some shelters in Dallas, Texas that have had some problems with this. But even when we're doing testing in Dallas now, it looks like it's kind of moved out of the community. pretty quickly. We're hoping that's true. We're sort of waiting and watching. So while it is something to be aware of, it's not something that we all need to, you know, be kind of constantly worrying about.
And is, especially if you're in an area with an outbreak, is vaccination an option? And if so, who is it worth thinking about vaccination for?
So vaccination is an option. And really, if you want to have your animal, your dog vaccinated for canine influenza, the time to do it is before there's an outbreak. The vaccination is a 2-vaccine series. So they need to have the first vaccine and then wait about 3 or 4 weeks and then get the second. And this is, it's all so much easier to talk about this stuff now that we've been in a pandemic. So at least there's a couple good things that come from that. But the vaccine is much like COVID in that it'll reduce the shedding that that dog would have. And it would usually reduce the clinical signs, but it won't prevent infection completely. So it's going to be a lot like what we've all experienced with the COVID vaccines.
And Dr. Newberry, if somebody has a dog who's having some kind of respiratory illness, as you say, the influenza is usually not too severe, what's some home care advice?
I mean, if your dog has an unexplained respiratory illness, in most cases, my advice is going to be that you should call your own veterinarian who knows that dog and knows their history, or take the animal in to see the veterinarian, because most dogs in a, you know, in a household setting shouldn't be developing respiratory disease. That would be uncommon. And if they got respiratory disease from going into doggy daycare, then you might want to find out, and you can do some diagnostic testing to just make sure it's not influenza or some other problematic thing. But it's, again, it's kind of like if a human has respiratory disease, most of the time, if it's not too severe, they're going to rest, and they may or may not need antibiotics depending on what's causing the respiratory disease. And then beyond that, it's going to be interventions that your veterinarian may or may not suggest.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Dr. Newberry, as you said, the influenza is not having outbreaks in Wisconsin now. Is there a place where, hey, if I'm in a job where I work with lots of dogs and I'm seeing lots of respiratory illness, do I report that to somebody?
I think anytime you're in a job and you're seeing a lot of respiratory disease in dogs, again, that some veterinarian should be aware of that. Or, you know, if you're in a doggy daycare center and all of the dogs are getting respiratory disease, for sure, that's something we should pay attention to. It's not normal for dogs to be developing respiratory disease. And so we want to respond whenever that's happening and figure out what we need to do differently in that environmental setting, or, you know, what kind of treatments those dogs need to get out of that situation.
Dr. Newberry, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Dr. Sandra Newberry, Director of the UW Shelter Medicine Program, Associate Professor in UW School of Veterinary Medicine, with us for a look at canine influenza and what you need to know about protecting your dog this season. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a mythical lumberjack and his ox.
We recently received a Wisconsin question from Ryan Urban of Rice Lake. He had a few questions about Paul Bunyan. Was he based on a real person? Did the tall tale begin in Wisconsin? And why is this legend still so popular? WPR's Jenny Peake set out to learn more about this flannel-wearing Northwoods lumberjack.
A job that needed a great big man, Paul Bunyan was the one.
Paul Bunyan stories are plentiful. He cleared forests with one swing of his axe. He and his trusty bovine, Babe the Blue Ox, dug the Great Lakes just to quench the thirst of his fellow loggers. He created the Mississippi River by simply dragging his axe behind him. He's a Wisconsin folk hero. But why? That's what Ryan Urban of Rice Lake wanted to know.
It's hard to travel around northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, Michigan for that matter, without seeing something Paul Bunyan related. And I guess I started to ask myself why.
I spoke with Michael Edmonds, a historian who researched and wrote the preeminent book on Paul Bunyan.
Paul Bunyan was, for decades in the last century, the best-known American folk hero. He was Thor. He was Ulysses. The first mention of Paul Bunyan's story being told dates to the winter of 1885-1886. in the town of Tomahawk.
Edmund says the stories began as an oral tradition, passed down by loggers until the start of World War I in 1914.
In that oral tradition, Bunyan is one of the guys. He's a lumberjack. He might be a crew leader, but he's a tough working class guy. He's not very bright. He doesn't know how to read and write, but he's very, very strong, of course, very, very large, can solve many problems with brute strength.
Fast forward to 1915, the Red River Lumber Company in Minneapolis began an advertising campaign capitalizing on Paul Bunyan's popularity. The company shared the lumberjack stories in a catalog that was mailed to lumberyards across the United States.
And so Bunyan escaped the woods into the lumber industry as a whole. And the Red River Lumber Company was brilliant because, like the Grateful Dead, they allowed people to reproduce their products. They did not copyright these stories. And so they were seized upon by other publishers.
But as Paul Bunyan's stories transitioned from oral tellings to print, the tales changed.
When they were told out loud, it was lumberjacks trying to tease or fool one another. When they hit print, the audience was middle-class people who buy books. And in the end, by the 1950s, they only survive as children's books.
With my double-blade axe and my hobnail boots, I go where the timber's tall. When there's work to be done, don't mess around, just sing right up or call.
And the tales are just that, stories. Edmund says there never was a real Paul Bunyan or Babe the Blue Ox.
There is no good evidence that there was anyone like Paul Bunyan. We want to believe in someone who can solve our problems, who's more powerful than we are as we face the challenges of life. And that was true for lumberjacks in the Wisconsin Northwoods in the 1880s and 90s, just like it's true for us today.
As for where Paul Bunyan hails from, well, that's here, in the Northwoods of Wisconsin.
Many, many states have claimed to be the birthplace of Paul Bunyan, but the only evidence that I could find places his birth, so to speak, not in Minnesota, but in north central Wisconsin. This was nostalgia. This was an idealized, mythical frontier like the one they recalled from their childhoods. So 1915 to 1960, maybe, it's really easy to understand why the stories were popular. After that, I don't know.
Reasoning aside, it seems Paul Bunyan is here to stay, along with the rivers, lakes, and hills he's said to have created.
WPR's Jenny Peek brought us that story on Paul Bunyan. And the story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talked to the guest curator behind an art exhibit in Appleton that looks at the complexities of indigenous identity and tribal enrollment policies that govern it. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. An art exhibit in Appleton is exploring indigenous identity through the work of 25 indigenous artists from Wisconsin, around the U.S., and Mexico. It's called Reclaiming Identity. In it, the artists take on themes like colonization, borders, and the policies that govern tribal enrollment. Dakota Mace is a Diné or Navajo artist. She's a photographer and researcher at UW-Madison. She served as the guest curator of the exhibit, which runs through January 8th at the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton. I talked to her about the project last Friday. This exhibit is called, as I mentioned, Reclaiming Identity. What does that idea, that theme, mean to you?
Yeah, so this was actually a bigger kind of inspiration in terms of looking at indigenous identity, and especially for indigenous artists, the way that we tell or share our stories in order to preserve not only our culture, but also our traditions. So reclaiming identity kind of fits into this larger theme of what does it mean to look at our identity through the complexity of blood quantum, but also kind of looking at bigger and broader themes of borders, family lineage, and shared histories.
Hey, you mentioned that phrase, blood quantum. I think for non-Native people, that may not be a familiar phrase. What is that, and why is it a theme you wanted to explore in this exhibit?
Yeah, so blood quantum for Indigenous people is a method of measurement that is used to determine Indigenous identity. either by their percentage or affiliation to a tribe. And this was implemented by the U.S. federal government in the 1900s, and today it's still something that many tribes continue to use within kind of determination, but for a lot of Indigenous people, especially for Indigenous artists, has kind of created a lot of complexity in terms of the response to, but also the conversation in terms of what does it mean to reclaim their identity, but also how can we push past this idea of blood quantum.
Can you give us a taste of some of the art we would see in this exhibit that tackles that issue?
Yeah, definitely. So we have a really amazing list of artists. We had over 25 Indigenous artists from across the U.S. and Mexico, and a couple of the artists that really kind of spoke to this idea of reclaiming identity was our recent series that focused on Isa Gargarin and Israel Campos, both who kind of explore identity through not only their community, but also looking at in terms abstracting that idea of what does it mean to be Indigenous and what does it mean to work within that realm, but also ways to give back to community, and especially for Israel's work, it was a chance to be able to explore his Chicano heritage and how that affects the Indigenous population, especially within LA.
We're talking to Dakota Mace about the new exhibit, Reclaiming Identity, at the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton. It runs there through January 8th. Dakota, looking at the list of artists, people are representing a wide variety of tribal backgrounds, geographical backgrounds across the U.S. Why was it important to have that that broad, diverse array of artists involved?
Yeah, so my intention for kind of inviting these different types of artists from all across the country was a chance to be able to have the audience kind of be able to explore the different ways of indigeneity that is presented. And this is something that often a lot of museum institutions, as well as kind of more broader gallery institutions, really don't give a chance for their audience to kind of explore, is like the different ways that indigeneity is presented. And especially in Wisconsin, oftentimes we don't get to experience indigenous art that comes, you know, from Mexico or from the Southwest. So to be able to invite these artists and kind of open up a larger window of what does it mean to be Indigenous and the different ways that our communities have really adapted and really challenged that way to present it within their works.
That said, there is some Wisconsin work as part of the exhibit. Can you highlight the Wisconsin side of things?
Yeah, definitely. So a couple of artists within the exhibition, such as John Hitchcock, Tom Jones, Monty Little, oh my gosh, there's so many names. Valeria Tateria. And I think one last one, Henry Payer, are all artists that are featured in the exhibition, but have either called Wisconsin home or currently living in Wisconsin.
Can you talk a little bit about the variety of styles of artwork, painting or sculpture or and textiles and so on? What kind of variety will we see when we walk through the door?
Yeah, so there is a big representation in terms of media within this exhibition. So when you come into the space, you are presented with paintings and photographs, but also textile work. And I wanted to be able to kind of have the audience experience these different ways of creating work, but also to kind of highlight the importance of these materials that a lot of these artists use. And especially on the second level of the gallery space, there is a focus more on traditional and non-traditional materials. So many artists played around with neon, such as John Hitchcock's work, or really explored traditional materials, such as the work of Michaela Payton, who utilized materials that come from her home and are connected to her tribe. So for a lot of these artists, it's a chance to be able to kind of push the materials themselves, but also kind of bring to light a better appreciation in terms of the way that their identity is translated through their work.
What are some of the things you like to explore in your own work as an artist?
So I work with a lot of materials as an artist. So I am trained as a photographer, but I do use a lot of textile and beadwork within my own practice. And that's something that I'm currently doing right now, is a combination of alternative photographic processes and beadwork, and eventually in the next coming months, combining that with textiles as well.
And I understand some of your work looks at ideas of cultural appropriation. What kind of things are you hoping to bring to people's attention?
Yeah, so that's something that I work with the University of Wisconsin-Madison through their design studies program, is that we are currently facilitating workshops through our textile collection, as well as through the program, to kind of bring this conversation and this issue in terms of the dialogue with cultural appropriation. So we invite students as well as community members to learn through these ideas of the importance and meaning behind appropriation, the kind of complex history behind it, but also to allow them to better understand what it means to work with those designs and designers.
Dakota, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Dakota Mace. She's a Diné or Navajo artist, also a photographer and researcher at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about an exhibit she guest curated for the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton, exploring Indigenous identity. The exhibit's called Reclaiming Identity. It runs through January 8th. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, motherhood was already challenging. The pandemic added a lot more problems and stress. We'll find out what changed with the author of the new book, Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Plus, from jobs to exercise to school, we're using games, points, and streaks as motivation. And that isn't always a healthy idea, according to the author of the new book, You've Been Played. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, could the age of the college essay be over? Our guest makes the case that AI-generated term papers are already here. The challenge is what to do about it in schools. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the House January 6th committee is recommending criminal charges against former President Donald Trump. We'll look at today's final public hearing and what comes next. First, the college paper or persuasive essay are common ways to grade students in college, sometimes in high school as well. And now the school paper may be turned upside down because of generative AI, so-called artificial intelligence. Advanced chatbot technology is here. It can write papers and make itself look pretty smart enough that it can be prompted to write papers that some would consider B-plus material. It's likely to get better. Our next guest says the educational system needs to figure out how to respond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the rise of this type of technology? Have you encountered it yourself in your job as a student or as a teacher, maybe yourself? Do you think that we need to change the way we evaluate students from the essay to what? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen Marsh is a novelist and essayist. He's the author of several books, including The Next Civil War and The Unmade Bed. His latest piece in The Atlantic is called The College Essay is Dead. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleasure to be with you, Rob.
You've been following and writing about this generative AI and other similar products for some time now. When it comes to coming up with documents that look like term papers, say, give us a sense of how quickly this technology has been emerging lately.
Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing where I sort of have my mind blown about once every 2 weeks. You know, like, it's just one of those things like, oh, you can do that now? Like, oh, my God. I mean, I would say the moment I had where I really had my mind blown was about 2 years ago, where I was using an application called PseudoWrite, which allows you to use GPT-3 to create writing. And I asked it to finish the poem Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, like, you know, in Xanadu to Kubla Khan, a stately pleasure dome to create, you know, that whole poem that was famously unfinished. And it finished it, and it was completely convincing. And it was like, it was like, if somebody told me that Coleridge had written that, I would believe it. And I think everyone else would believe it too. So I've been sort of like, I think the past couple of weeks as ChatGPT has shown up, people are really starting to understand the power of this stuff. But I have, you know, I knew from that moment that the undergraduate essay was more or less doomed.
Now, GPT-3, ChatGPT, can you talk a little bit about how it works? It's not, I mean, we say artificial intelligence. It's not intelligent, artificially or otherwise. What's it doing?
Okay. So I've talked to the great an engineer who invented Transformer. I've talked to like people who did Palm at Google, which is 540 billion parameters. I don't feel like I'm an idiot. But on the other hand, I don't want to deceive your listeners into thinking that I can describe this in an accurate way that would be technically accurate. The most important thing to remember is that all it is text prediction software. All it does is creates what is the most logical continuation of a passage, right? And so that's all that it does. And to do that, I mean, to give it in the most crude description, it searches language for patterns of coherence. These are the parameters, and then applies them to make more coherent language. So when you have something like when you have GPT-3, which has 175 billion parameters, that has incredible powers. But when you get to something like Google's Palm, which has 540 billion parameters, it can do things like low-level reasoning, and where you can instruct it using parables and things like that, and it will learn from them. And yeah, and it gets crazy the higher the number of parameters go and the more sophisticated the intelligence gets.
All right, here I am, an undergraduate student. It's been a day or two, but pretend. Papers due. So what do I input? What do I get out if I try to have these programs, these systems write my paper for me?
Well, let's take an example. I mean, off the top of my head, what do the three witches in Macbeth mean, and how do they relate to the action of the play, right? Like, typical. Does that sound like an undergraduate question to you?
Sure.
Yeah. You go to ChatGPT-3, you put in that exact question, you say, write this in the style of that, and it produces it. You would then have to fact check it, then you'd have to correct it, but it would definitely give you a strong, say, well, however many words you asked for. So like if you asked it for 1,000 words, it would give you 1,000 words on that question, and they would be pretty good.
And you looked at a paper written by one of these, by somebody else who'd input parameters. What did it look like something that you could read and say, yeah, maybe a human wrote this, then did a decent job?
Yeah, but, I've been a professor, so I remember grading undergraduate papers, and like many of them were totally incoherent, right? This was quite coherent. Right. But I think you have to understand, like, there are a number of examples going around. But, you know, I have a friend who's using this because his kids in French immersion here because we're in Canada, and they don't have enough of a particular kind of children's book that his kid likes. So he's gone to ChatGPT and said, can you write this story in French for my 6-year-old son to read? And it does it, and the kid reads it. Right. I mean, we're entering a world of a fundamentally different relation to text production.
Talking to Stephen Marsh. He wrote a piece in The Atlantic called The College Essay is Dead. Why? Because these online systems, these generative learning AI systems, can write papers that look pretty plausible for college, maybe even high school. You can join in with your questions if you have experiences with this, if you have concerns about what it can mean for education and beyond. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stephen, a big point of your piece is, hey, higher education, I'm guessing high school education too, get ready for this. What do you want to see the teachers and professors and administrators thinking about?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I'm not paid the big bucks. I'm not a university administrator. I don't have to deal with this problem. I just have to point it out. Like, actually dealing with it seems to me like an incredible quagmire that I have no idea how to solve. I mean, I actually think because, you know, what this doesn't end is not the craft of writing, or necessarily the craft of shaping an argument or finding intention in an argument, which is very different. But the confrontation with the blank page, like a student just being like, I have to write 1500 words. Here's a blank computer screen. I have to fill it. That getting that first draft, I think that's really dead. And so the question then becomes, you know, is this even cheating? Because it's a tool. You're not using somebody else's intelligence. It's not cheating to use a thesaurus or spell check. Is this even cheating? I mean, that's one question that you have to deal with. But I actually think like methods of evaluation are going to have to change. I mean, I think the take-home exam is pointless at this point. But I also think like things like oral exams are going to return, like where you're actually talking to students and figuring out what they know from talking to them. That is also going to return, because simply seeing an undergraduate essay is not going to mean that they composed it.
I remember in high school, something I really resented for a term paper was, I had to, you know, first list some of the sources and start outlines and basically show my work in stages as the semester went on. Is that a method you think could defeat this?
That's a smart teacher, right? Yeah. I mean, like, I think there are techniques for dealing with this. And I do think the essay, I mean, you know, I have made my living basically from writing essays my whole life, but I do think it is an important step in learning how to think through things. And learning how to research things and learning how to figure things out in your own mind and how to put them down in a way that is communicable to other people. I think it is important just simply as a technique to master for other things. So I think there's going to be a lot of approaches like that the teachers are going to have to take. Because just simply like grading like the say a bunch of papers that come in and the students have done them in the privacy of their own home, I think that's going to be, you know, that's not going to register what you think it's registering anymore.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kylie is with us in Sparta. Kylie, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So what I wanted to say is I'm currently finishing my master's degree in special education. Just finishing. Tomorrow's my last day of student teaching. And I'm going through Grand Canyon University in Arizona. It's an online course. What I was telling the person that answers the phones is, for our work, we have to send it in for a similarity report, and that looks through the entire web of information where things are generated, and we can't have a higher similarity score than 20%. So when you have these websites that create these documents, then they're saved. And so then if you're copying it, it's going to show 100%. You can't turn it in.
Kylie, thanks for that call. More power to you. My mom is a retired special ed teacher, so you're doing good work there. Thank you, and congrats on finishing student teaching. Stephen, she's talking about that plagiarism check that is done online. And maybe that would work here. It's not exactly plagiarism, but if everybody's special ed final paper looks kind of the same because it came from the same programs, it's going to start ringing some bells?
Well, you know, I think so this stuff doesn't register on Turnitin.com. ChatGPT, there's been some talk that they are going to actually provide every code, essentially put a code in for each block of text produced, which would allow an institution or a university to check against it. Right? Like to check whether it has actually been produced by ChatGPT. I'm sure, you know, ChatGPT-3 is not the only technology capable of doing this. There are other programs out there, Jasper AI, my favorite Cohere in Toronto, like that do the similar stuff with similar effects. So, you know, finding an irresponsible large language model is not going to be particularly difficult for anybody. But then I also would point out that I don't think a smart student would use this as a they would just put it in and then take whatever came out, because first of all, sometimes the machines hallucinate, right? Like every now and then they produce an answer that is completely unrelated to reality, right? Mm-hmm. And that would get you an F, right? So what this would be used for is that you generate this text, and it would essentially be a first draft generator that you would check, and then you would fool around with the language and the wording and make your own in some way. And that's what it would do to me, rather than just completely create a whole text that you would just you know, hand in after 5 minutes. It would actually just reduce the hardest process, part of the writing process, which is the first draft.
Kylie, thanks for the call. We are talking to novelist and essayist Stephen Marsh about the disruptive power of generative AI computer systems that can now compile things that look a lot like college essays, maybe even a high school paper, and produce things that look like art, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this could change education? Do you have thoughts on this if you work with students at any level? Do you have concerns about what this could mean if a computer basically could generate their paper for them, ideally with a bit of redrafting along the way? Call it at 800-642-1234. Do you see positive uses of this human and AI-like thing working together? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with novelist and essayist Stephen Marsh, talking about his latest piece for The Atlantic. It's called The College Essay is Dead. Nobody's prepared for how AI will transform academia. There are systems and algorithms where you input some ideas and talking points and it generates the length of paper that you want. How does that change education? Does it? Call 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. If you've been able to play around with some of these things yourself, love to hear about your experience at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen, you get into a deeper point in that essay about kind of a divide that's growing between what we think of as the humanities and technology world. And you say, these kind of things may force them to talk to each other again. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're dealing with the technology of language, right? And specifically of the aesthetics of language in a really, you know, fascinating way. I do think the two sides, at least from my experience, are quite removed on this point. You have technologists who, you know, don't really understand literature, don't really understand history, you know, just or regard humanistic questions as like, you know, everybody's entitled to an opinion kind of questions. And then you have humanities, on the other hand, who are, you know, still engaged in pretty navel-gazing debates about their own relevance and also resistant to technology and you know, engaged in a refusal to see its potential. But I think this technology is so wonderful. I mean, I really am a big fan. Like, I know we do these pieces where it's like we're afraid of things and it's going to ruin the essay, but I actually think this is going to be a marvelous technology that's going to create very beautiful, fascinating things, and is going to create new art forms and new genres of expression. And I think everyone's going to see that if when these two sides get together, it's going to be magic. And I mean, that may sound utopian, but I actually think that both sides kind of recognize that that's where their future lies for both of them.
I've seen arguments in the past before we had these kind of programs about ways humans can embrace technology. I think the word centaur came up, kind of get the best of both worlds. As a creator, as a writer yourself, what are some of your visions for how that beauty could come out of this?
Well, I mean, it hasn't been published yet, but I've just written a short story with an engineer at Cohere where it's a prompt story. So we built it on prompts, like do this, do that throughout, and then trained it on examples. And it creates an infinitely regenerative story. So it's the same piece of fiction. It's the same characters. It's the same thing, but it's different every time. It's expressed differently every time. That's just me fooling around with an engineer, right? Like I think there's, like I did write an entirely automatically generated short story for LitHub recently, and one that was 17% computer generated for the LA Review of Books. I mean, I think this is a whole new approach to making language that's going to have, I don't think we know what it is yet. I don't think we've seen the kind of creative chatbots that are going to emerge from this, but they're coming. And I think if we don't mess it up too badly, they could be wonderful.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So, Rob, I have a question. How are you even certain that your guest wrote his article? I mean, you know, I'm kidding, obviously, but, you know, if it can do this, why wouldn't it change everything from, you know, pieces, editorial pieces in newspapers to magazine articles to everything else? And it's just, there's no independent thought, you know. That being said, I will say that, you know, the Bible refers to it. It says nothing's new under the sun. You know, there's always so many storylines. So, I mean, this has kind of been sort of a problem that's been going on all along, too.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call. Now, I've seen experiments with generating, say, oh, we need to write up all our high school sports results and we don't have any reporters anymore. Feed in the stats. It writes up a thing. Right. There are ripoff sites that take other people's news sites, paraphrase them, and write, quote unquote, new articles. I don't know. Stephen, it could be that there is a news article out there that's written, generated this way, and we don't know about it.
Well, a big piece that I wrote for the Atlantic, like, 3 months ago called Of Gods and Machines, like, not to spoil the thing too much, but 2/3 of the way through, I put in computer generated text. Mm-hmm. And then I revealed afterwards, like, actually this part was computer generated and no one noticed, right? Like, my editors didn't notice. They didn't say like, oh, you can't have that stuff in, right? Like, because that's obviously wrong. It's like, no, that it sounded and looked exactly like me. Right. So, like, this is definitely coming. But, you know, I would also remind you that this is just text prediction software. So it doesn't have any intention. Right. It doesn't have a will. It is not like when you write an essay, you're actually willing something into existing. You're intending a meaning to come into existence. And a computer can't do that. Computer has no intention. It's just an algorithm. It's a series of instructions. Right. And so, you know, like, I don't think this is going to take any jobs away from anyone at all, genuinely. Like, I don't think it's going to, I think it's going to be a tool that people are going to use, but, you know, I don't think it's going to destroy writing. What, you know, we live in a world with a lot of fake text in it anyway. I mean, I get letters all the time that says, "Dear Mr. Marsh, you are one of our most valued customers," right? That kind of language is totally, you know, it may as well be written by a machine anyway. So, like, that kind of language, like, for example, low-level legal contracts, things like this, that language is going to be seriously challenged by ChatGPT and other text generators. But writing, like, I think writing is going to matter more than ever.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus. And Stephen, is this maybe a call to embrace a more unique voice when we speak and write and create art? Because I remember when I wrote school papers, I think the incentive was to make them really boring to fit the genre. Is that
Absolutely.
Something we need to get away from?
Well, I think what will matter is the intentionality, you know, because, like, you know, it's sort of like, I mean, when I was a kid, now this is a long time ago, but spelling really mattered. That was real evidence of something in your brain. Like, they thought you were smart because you could spell, right? And that's gone, right? Like, that is a historical artifact, right? And I think it will be the same with low-level craft of writing. Like, just simply being able to make a coherent, cogent argument, which is not easy. Like, people treat it like it's actually quite hard to do. That's about to become a lot easier from a technical point of view. So what will matter more is what you're expressing and what you intend and how you pierce a subject, you know, and how you look at things and how you observe them. I mean, but, you know, we're still in early days here. Like, you know, the other thing is, like, GPT-4 could come out, you know, 2 weeks from now, and then you'd have to have me back on the show to talk through all the consequences of that, because God knows what they'll be.
Stephen, we'll leave it there and watch for that. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Stephen Marsh, novelist and essayist. We talked to him today about the power of machine learning and generative AI to disrupt lots of stuff, potentially, including text-generating programs that could kill the college essay. But as you heard, he sees a lot of potential positive outcomes of it as well. Coming up after the news, the final public hearing from the January 6th committee concluded this afternoon with a recommendation for criminal charges against former President Trump. We'll talk to a Wisconsin political scientist about where things could go from here. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.